This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the studio with us, Angela Baca. Angela is an Oregon-based freelance journalist, author, editor, and political strategist. For over the last 10 years, she has been the editor of multiple publications, including Cannabis Now magazine, and has edited 8 cannabis books and nearly 1,000 professional articles on the topic. Wow. You're a walking, talking encyclopedia, Angela.
Yeah, everything's archived in my brain at the moment.
That's great. That's great. You need to get it out on paper. I have some questions for you, and then we're going to throw the phones open to our listeners, and quite a few of them have questions for you already. My first question for you is, what medical conditions do we know that pot works for?
Yeah, so I mean, the easy way to answer that question would be to give you the list of conditions that are usually listed on almost every state medical marijuana program. But I want to kind of take another approach to that, because the thing about that is that that's really a Western medical approach. And as somebody with a disease, I know that when I get my disease treated, we look at the symptoms that I'm trying to treat and usually prescribe medicines based on that. So cannabis can help the symptoms of almost every condition you could possibly imagine. So on that note, I'd say it could cause a benefit for almost anything physical or mental, because it treats...
How and why?
Because it treats pain, inflammation, insomnia, lack of appetite, seizures, nausea, better than most pharmaceutical drugs and in a safer way. So everybody who uses it starts going off pharmaceuticals one by one. The pharmaceutical approach, if you have an autoimmune disease like what I have, is to shut down your immune system.
You have Crohn's disease, right?
I have Crohn's disease, right. To shut down my immune response to whatever is causing the inflammation, rather than treating all of the individual symptoms themselves, and cannabis can do that. I also like to point out that if you have alcohol addiction or anxiety or depression that normally you would look to alcohol or other illegal drugs to treat, cannabis is definitely a safer alternative, and in that sense, yeah, it can treat addiction too.
So, you know, we know about glaucoma. That's well advertised. Insomnia. Mm-hmm. I think there's a broad consensus there. Pot helps you sleep. What are some of the things that you said we could go through the list of the state medical marijuana laws? What is typically on those lists?
AIDS, cancer, glaucoma, autoimmune disease like multiple sclerosis, Crohn's disease. The main thing, though, that's on some lists that isn't on most lists is pain. Mm. And pain is the number one treated symptom of any condition in the United States. And cannabis works so much better than things that are much more dangerous to treat it on a daily basis. So on that note, I would say it's appropriate for everybody. It's safer than Advil.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Actually, one of my brothers has kidney failure as a result of taking too much Advil.
Right, or
another brand, but same thing. You know, is one of those over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, and they do whack your kidneys.
In the cannabis space and the drug world, generally we use the term harm reduction, which is if I can take a drug like ibuprofen to solve this problem, but I can take something that has less harm, then we go for the harm reduction alternative. It's the same thing with opiates or alcohol. Cannabis is safer than both.
So for people who are using opioids, particularly older adults, but I think this would apply to everybody. I mean, you know, my experience of pain and smoking pot was that the pain didn't vanish. I mean, the pain was still there, but instead of being kind of cocooned by the pain, surrounded by the pain, having the pain completely interpenetrate my body, the pain moved off next to me. Mm-hmm. And it was like I was looking at my pain rather than being my pain. I don't know how to describe it beyond that, but it was a remarkable experience before I had my back surgery.
One of the best ways I can describe that is when I was younger, I was a ballet dancer, and I had a ballet teacher who had sprained her ankle, and so she was given heavy pharmaceutical opiates that she used during her dance classes, and because she couldn't feel the pain, she continued dancing on it, and it got worse.
Oh.
So with cannabis, it's a situation where if I use it, I can feel my pain, and I can know what I'm doing that's wrong, but the point is to try to do other alternative medical things to reduce the pain itself rather than just treating it.
Yeah.
And so if you can feel what you're doing to yourself, that really helps. It does make pain more tolerable, even if you have to have it.
That dissociation mm-hmm. experience was just remarkable. It was a kind of a variation on a personality dissociative experience I had taking acid when I was a teenager, but it was really quite different. It wasn't, you know, acid can be kind of scary, pot is kind of, you know, comforting.
Well, and pain is your body's way of telling you that something is wrong. And so it shouldn't just be something that's ignored or numbed. It should be something that's like actually treated.
Yeah, yeah. So. Pot and sex. New studies show that marijuana enhances and increases the frequency of sex. Is that true?
I don't know that we need studies for that. I can tell you from personal experience, it absolutely does, especially because with my husband, we like to smoke weed together every night, and we'll talk about our day and talk about anything. And so we have this mental connection that has been so enhanced by cannabis that, of course, the physical sensation of using cannabis while you have sex is just that much more enhanced as well.
That makes perfect sense. So. That makes perfect sense. A great story. Okay, let's pick up some phone calls here. We've got people with questions. Van in Gordonville, Virginia. You are on the air with Angela Baca.
Oh, thank you very much for your work, and I appreciate it. I know a bit about THC and CBD, but I don't know anything about CBN or CBG.
Okay.
Can you tell me about that?
CBN, CBG.
So let's start with CBG. CBG, cannabigerol, is the precursor to THC and CBD. And as it synthesizes in the plant as it's growing, it either becomes THC or CBG or CBD. CBG might be good for tumor reduction. We know it's good for pain and a lot of other things. We're still studying it, so we don't really know. However, if you get any cannabis product that's high in THC or CBD, there will be CBG in it already. On CBN, I think we talked about this one last week a little bit, that's cannabinol, and that is aged or degraded THC, and it's the one that makes you sleepy. And so if you have pot that's been sitting around for a while, it turns into CBN, the Delta 9 THC turns into CBN, and that will put you to sleep.
How long does it take, and is there any way to speed that process up? This reminds me of aging wine. You know, you want to drink a wine that's 10 or 20 years old, and it's like, whoa, this is so much better than, you know, brand new How do you do that?
I don't know exactly the time frame on how it would take to convert to the CBN, because I think it would depend on the individual plant and the amount of Delta 9 THC and how fast that plant itself is converting, because the genetics are different. But there are, as I mentioned last week, products on the market already that are already high in CBN. Another way to get high CBN if you're growing yourself is to harvest late, to wait till it's past its peak and then harvest, because all that Delta 9 THC is mostly degraded to CBN already.
Oh, that's interesting, because a friend of mine said, you know, you want to, because I've got one pot plant growing, right? We went out and fought, and he said, you know, you want to wait until the buds turn kind of yellow, and it sounds, and then get them quick, like within a day. But you're saying,
yeah, so if you look at
the
leaves of the plant while they're growing, they have little glands on them called trichomes, and that's where all the cannabinoids are being developed. So you can harvest early and get different cannabinoids than you'd get when you harvest late. Most of what we're consuming is harvested right on time when it's ripe, when the little heads are starting to turn an amber color, which means they have more Delta 9 THC. The darker they get, the more likely they're degrading into CBN.
Wow, that sounds good. As a fan of stuff that makes me feel sleepy, that sounds great. Dion in Round Lake, Illinois. Hey, Dion, you're on the air with Angela.
The CBD oil helps older dogs with arthritis, and my question is, with someone with schizoaffective disorder and autism, what do you recommend for anxiety and getting that euphoric feeling to get their creative project?
So if I heard you right, it said that you had schizophrenia as well.
Schizoaffective disorder. Yeah.
I would definitely not take any advice from anyone like me, but go see a licensed doctor who has experience with these things, because schizophrenia or anything schizo-related definitely has an interplay with THC, and it's not that the THC will cause schizophrenia, but it could exacerbate it in people.
Right.
And so I don't want to make any recommendations on that. You should see a doctor.
Yeah, tread carefully. Mm-hmm. Cassandra in Hollywood, California. You're on with Angela Baca.
Hi. Two things. One, I have a bit of a testimonial. My cat has cancer and was given about a two-year life expectancy. He's been on vet CBD oil, and he's approaching 3.5 years. So that's a wonderful thing that I'm really glad we have that available to us here in California. And this, my question is about munchies. I used to smoke more, and I was gaining weight. I realized that pot is a treatment for anorexia, and there might be some linkage there. And I'm just wondering if you have any way to combat that, or what types of marijuana are less about the munchies? Anything, any recommendations are greatly welcome.
Yeah, you know, I personally don't have a problem with the munchies, and I think that's probably part of my Crohn's disease, is I have trouble getting an appetite, so I'm usually looking for the exact opposite. I would definitely avoid higher THC strains and kind of go lower onto the CBD itself, and that's the best I would say on munchies.
As somebody who struggles with this, I would add, there's a whole spectrum of foods that you can eat that don't cause you to gain weight, that satisfy the munchies. You don't have to go to sugar. You can go to salt. Nothing in my experience, there's nothing as wonderful as freshly sliced cucumbers with a little bit of salt on them, or freshly sliced tomatoes, I go through a couple of packs of radishes a week. You know, when I get the munchies at night, Louise and I are smoking, and it's like, you know, I would really like to have a brownie, but no, I'm going to eat five radishes, and it fills my stomach up.
Yeah, know? And so I'm with my Crohn's disease, I use the specific carbohydrate diet, so mm-hmm. I don't eat grains, sugars, or starches, and so if I do get the munchies, my big sweet is a banana, like
there
a really
go.
Ripe banana, and that will fill you up faster than candy will.
There you go.
And so will water.
Yep. Rick in Texas, you're on the air with Angela.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
I live in Texas, as you know, and we now have legal CBD extract and oil. I thought, great, it'll help with my gout and my arthritis. But no, it's only going to be used for extreme epilepsy, and Abbott has made that very clear. My question to you is, at what point are we going to have enough states that have legal marijuana that can be used for medical purposes to where states don't have to worry about the DEA coming after their programs and feel that they're being bullied by the USDA?
Well, it's really the FDA that you're being bullied by, not the USDA. But the problem is that we now have all but six states in the U.S. that have some sort of medical cannabis legislation, including these stupid, really highly restrictive CBD laws, which are flawed and not based on any sort of science.
Which is what Texas did, apparently.
Right. Texas is one of those states. And so I was living in Salt Lake City during the time Utah became the first state to make a CBD-only law, which then was replicated in these conservative states. And after watching that process, I don't think it's about a quantity of states hitting medical marijuana. I think it's about all of us blowing up our legislators' phones and telling them that we need federal descheduling and decriminalization now, because the plant is safe, everyone should have access to be able to grow it at home, and then we should let commercial markets be regulated by the states.
Yeah, and Canada is doing that next month, as I recall.
Right.
Starts in October.
You know, and here in Oregon, we have a huge supply glut. We have a huge supply glut in California.
I've noticed the price is dropping. Well, as a consumer.
And part of that problem is because under legalization, we can produce as much as we want legally here in state, but it can't leave the state. And so that's dropping the prices and benefiting producers that have lots of money behind them. So we need to be able to export that to other states that have medical, like Texas and Utah, because
right.
they would love to get it overnight in the mail, but we need to talk to
go.
The federal government
but we've
about
got to
that.
Deschedule it.
Right.
We'll be back with more of your questions for Angela Baca right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And by the way, you can tweet Angela at Angela Baca, AngelaBacca. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Ed in Grass Valley, California. You're on the air with Angela Baca.
Hello.
Hey, Ed. Great name for your town.
It's a weed capital, too.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So what's up, Ed? Your question?
Yeah. I've got some physical issues. I've got a joint replacement in my hip and my shoulder that I'm going to need to have at some point. I've been on opiates for years. I figured out that through the internet that the CBD oil could help with that. I've been on it for about a month and a half, and it's kind of hard to get the dosing down because I don't really want to get high. I just want to get well. I want to get off the opiates. So I've been kind of microdosing. Is that something that is there a? It's kind of hard to explain, but. What dosage that you take with the CBD oil I don't want to get high. I just want to get pain-free.
So first, I want to challenge that statement that you don't want to get high because the opiates are making you high, and so are a lot of other legal drugs. CBD will never get you high, not in the sense that you think THC would, especially because the way CBD binds on our endocannabinoid receptors with THC, it mitigates the effects of THC. So first, I would kind of try to get past that cultural, I don't want to get high idea, because you really want relief and you want to feel better. And if that's what's called high, then who cares? Second, we've found that people find equal parts of THC and CBD to be the most effective. There's no good way to dose an herbal medicine ever except to take a small amount, see how it affects you, and then slightly increase the dose until you get the relief you need.
Right. Ed?
Yeah. Well, I would beg to differ, because the first time I did do the 4-to-1, I think it was, I got stoned when I was young, and I know what it felt like. So.
Oh yeah, but now that 25% is enough.
And that's also a tolerance thing. When you're taking an opiate drug, it's usually the same compound of opiate, and the more you take of it, the more tolerant you become, and the more you need to feel the same effects.
Right.
And so cannabis is many compounds in one. So you'll never have to increase the dose, but you will be able to become more tolerant to that effect over time. I don't get high anymore.
Huh. That's interesting. We have just a minute to the break. Dolly, a quick one from Santa Cruz, California. You're on the air with Angela.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to the conversation, and I just wanted to say that I have a lot of family and friends who are in the medical profession, and they administer some very serious medications for pain, and they know and have worked with a lot of people for years and years, and frankly, they speak to me quite honestly about the attitudes and behaviors of people who deal with pain medication. And a lot of the medical professionals out there really don't have a lot of compassion for people's pain. And she says that the amount of medication that they're willing to give is very, very little compared to the amount of pain that people are suffering. And these are private conversations we have, but you know, I think the two of us are very compassionate people, and we understand what pain is all about and how much suffering there is out there with human beings. And just to get to the point, you know, my boyfriend has suffered from chronic pain for over 10 years, and I've seen him live through it. It's pretty awful.
Yeah. Dolly, thank you for sharing your perspective with us. We'll pick up that issue of pain when we come back on the other side of this break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Angela Baca is with us taking your calls. She is a marijuana expert, Oregon-based freelance journalist, author, editor. She has, over the last 10 years, been the editor of multiple publications, including Cannabis Now magazine, has edited 8 cannabis books and nearly 1,000 professional articles on the topic. We had a caller that just before the break who was talking about just how pervasive serious pain is in our society. Part of the condition of the human race, and how schizophrenic, essentially, the medical profession has been with regard to opiates. You know, 10 years ago, it was like, here, have all you want. And now it's like, no, you can't even have enough to stop the pain. And what role cannabis might play in this bizarre little psychodrama we're watching.
Yeah, so I've edited a lot of books for Dr. David Bierman, who is an addictionologist, pain medicine specialist, and cannabis doctor from California who's been on the topic for 25 years. What he points to a lot of the time is opiate phobia, which has been induced by the opiate epidemic, which, of course, was created by pharmaceutical companies selling opiates. So we have a situation now where we know people are dying from taking too much of this, and it's made doctors afraid of prescribing medicine to people who legitimately need it, and that's unfortunate. Something I mentioned last time, too, is we still have never actually scientifically proven that these single compound opiate drugs are safer than botanically diverse opium. So we don't actually know if maybe the real plant is less addictive than these hardcore drugs we've made.
I absolutely believe it is.
I do too.
You know, I've smoked opium. I've eaten opium. It's completely different from the high that you get from the synthesized, from morphine, from heroin, from even codeine.
And this is something that's standard in the pharmaceutical industry. We have something called biopiracy, where they go and find these plants that are medicinal and have been used as medicines for thousands of years with lots of different cultures, and isolate out one compound, patent it, and make it a drug.
Yeah.
But we already know with cannabis, at least, that the best effects are coming from all of the compounds in the plant working in synergy together.
Right, the terpenes and all the different
and it mitigates a lot of the effects. We have a pharmaceutical drug, which is pure THC, Marinol, a Schedule 3 drug, FDA approved since the 80s, and everybody who uses it tends to go straight to the flower afterwards because it's not right.
Right. So that's interesting. If raw opium was available for people with serious pain, that would be fascinating. That's a whole another you know, can of worms or whatever. But
think of it this way, though, too. With salt, if you don't have salt already in food and you put it on top of your food, you can't ingest too much because it starts tasting bad to you.
Right. Right. So we have an instinctive mechanism
right.
to deal with
titrating.
This kind of stuff. There you go. We're hitting the break here. We're hitting. Yeah. It's the break at the bottom of the hour. Boy, we've got calls for you from Arizona, Oregon, Montana, Minnesota, Nevada, I don't know what LO is, Louisiana, I'm guessing Michigan. So we'll be back with more calls for, if you can stick around, for Angela Baca, our in-house marijuana expert. Stick around. We're answering your questions and taking a little bit of a break from Brett Kavanaugh and all the craziness in D.C.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Angela has some opinions on that, too. We'll be back. Welcome back. Angela Baca is with us taking your calls on marijuana. And let's see here. Mike in Minneapolis. Let's see on AM 950. Mike, you're on the air with Angela.
Hi, Tom. I'm a 64-year-old hippie from Minneapolis, and something came up during the last election campaign where a group of federal legislators were together for some reason, and the question was put to them, and their answer came back that, well, we have to admit, we know very, very little about marijuana. And he was talking about the state of research and what was available and everything. Now, people my age remember Nixon's $1 million commission, which was supposed to be the end all on marijuana. They were going to do the research, bring in all of the experts of all the different fields, study it, find the answers, eliminate the myths. And when they came back to Nixon, they said, how come we're throwing people's lives away over this stuff? And Nixon hit the ceiling, and he sent him back out with $2 million, and they sat out another year and came back with their, you know, you should make those hippies stand in the corner and say that they're not going to do this anymore. And since then, we've spent a lot of money, a lot of federal money, state money, money from different organizations on marijuana research for them to say that they know nothing. I'm wondering, is there a way we can find an actual figure? How much money has the government spent on marijuana research, even though most of it's bad science, like that guy who had the monkeys down in Louisiana where the control group and the research group were both dying at the same rate? And,
Mike, let's let Angela answer the question.
I don't know that there's, it's really about finding the dollar amount of how much they've spent so much as looking at the quality of the research done. The United States government has been growing weed for research at the University of Mississippi since the 60s or the 70s, and it's notoriously low quality. It's less than 6% THC, which is a third of what we find on legal markets. So I don't know that the research that they're doing is very useful. Also, I've spoken with Dr. Sue Sisley, who is got an FDA-approved study to work with veterans with PTSD and cannabis, and they sent her moldy cannabis to work with her veterans, so she suspended the study. So really, we already have people using this in large quantities all over the place. Here we are in Oregon. It's everywhere.
Right.
Why don't we just study how people are already using it and move on?
Are there good studies out of other countries?
There are great studies out of other countries because they're actually looking at this in other countries. Some of the best studies are coming out of the European Union. We have European Union finance studies in Madrid that are looking at the anti-cancer properties of cannabis. We have great ones coming out of Israel and the United Kingdom as well.
Yeah, Israel is, cannabis is medicine in Israel, in a big way.
Israel is the home of cannabis medicine research. In 1963 and 64, Dr. Raphael Mashulam first isolated and identified both CBD and THC and has led the charge on cannabis research since then.
Wow, good stuff. Rich in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich, you're on the air with Angela Baca.
I want to know if she's ever heard of the seed method to distinguish male and female, because a lot of people have a big issue with wasting time and growing with seed, and then they just, you know, clone with cuttings.
Yeah, I don't know what you mean by the seed method specifically, but if you wanted to be able to identify if your seeds were male or female before growing them, there are services now provided by companies like Local Phylos Bioscience here in Portland, where they'll do a DNA test on your plant as soon as it sprouts leaves and look for the X or Y chromosome and be able to give you a report back within a week of sprouting.
Remarkable. Plants have extra Y chromosomes too. That's...
Yep, they have human DNA almost like ours. We share something like 40 to 60% of our DNA with the cannabis plant.
Wow.
And most other living things on the planet.
Yeah. Erwin in Missoula, Montana. You're on the air with Angela Baca.
Yes. Hello. Say, I'm not Jeff Sessions, but I was in treatment for alcoholism, and there was one or two people in treatment with me that primarily marijuana was the problem. Usually it was associated with alcohol, which is a much bigger problem. I know from experience that way back in the day I was smoking hash, which must be a high percentage of THC. My main concern is that I think there is a slight danger with marijuana, not like other drugs, but there is. And I'm concerned that maybe not enough regulations being put forth in recreational marijuana. Now, medical marijuana is different, but that's just my opinion.
So you want to speak to abuse potential, basically?
Yeah, let's talk about addiction, because I don't think that we actually talk about addiction in a real way. Drugs are not magic, and they're not good and evil, and they don't just hook you magically. Most addiction is underlied by untreated trauma, people who have some sort of trauma from their childhood or from a past abuse that they're trying to numb down. If you get to anybody who's addicted to anything, you've seen the show Hoarders even, their problem almost always stems out of an untreated trauma. So I don't want us to actually look at drugs as if they're the problem so much as ignoring people's mental abuses. As far as cannabis being addictive, it's about as addictive as coffee. That is real, and it is a lot safer for people to numb their pain with other things, but we really need to have real conversations about abuse and trauma in this country and how to really treat addiction without just looking at drugs as the cause.
Are you familiar with the Rat Park studies?
No.
The psychologist, I think he was in Minneapolis, did these studies back 15, 20 years ago, where he was looking at rats. This was back when Reagan was saying, you know, just say no, right? And cocaine, this is your brain on cocaine. And he thought, you know, all these studies on rats getting addicted to cocaine and heroin and other substances, they were all done with individual rats in 1-square-foot cages. Mm-hmm. If I was put in a 1-square-foot cage, I'd take all the heroin I could get. So he said, let's see if how these rats are affected in their natural environment. So he built this rat park. It was like, you know, a quarter of an acre, and it had little rat motels and places where rats could have sex and places where rats could raise their young and places where rats could play, and it had little spinning wheels and nobody harassed them and there were no predators. And then he put bottle of water with cocaine, bottle of water with heroin, take your choice, rats. And even the rats that had been addicted to cocaine and heroin in the 1-by-1 cages, when they were moved into the rat park, stopped having any taste at all for those drugs and just drank the water.
Right.
So it's not just trauma. It's like our entire society is traumatizing all of us, particularly economically. Anybody, you know, who's like in the bottom third of our economy is experiencing ongoing trauma.
And I want to push back on the idea that the regulation is, we need more regulation. As a medical user, I've found that whenever there's more regulation, it actually just impairs my own personal access. But as far as recreational use, what is recreational use? To me, that is a category that was determined by the government to excise more taxes and to create more regulations. And really, if you're using cannabis because you're anxious in crowds or because you just want to relax after work, you've made a choice that's medically a lot safer for you. And if you were to ask Dennis Perrone, who passed away at the beginning of the year, who is the godfather of medical marijuana in California, all use is medical.
Yeah, there you go. Colleen in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Colleen, you're on the air with Angela Baca.
Hi, Angela and Tom. I have a question for you. I'm 60 years old, and I believe that I'm probably going through some, I hope early, but no, menopausal symptoms. And I would like to know, which product do you recommend for night sweats, restlessness, insomnia, and I'm sorry to say, but some mood swings?
So I personally can't make a product recommendation to this, but I do know another cannabis writer named Sharon Letts who had a lot of trouble through her menopause, and she wrote extensively about all the different methods she went to do that, and she went off like 10 pharmaceuticals. So if you look up Sharon Letts, L-E-T-T-S, she has extensive writing on cannabis and menopause.
Okay, that's great. Shannon in Chamotte, Louisiana, is that right, Shannon? Where are you?
It's Chalmette, Louisiana. That's
Chalmette.
Okay. I have MS, and I have a CPA designation, and it is now medically legal for me in Louisiana once the dispensary finally opens in the next couple of months. But the problem is I can still get fired if I use it because the doctor only can recommend it.
I know that the FDA just approved a drug with CBD in it. My question is, if I got my doctor to prescribe me the CBD FDA approved pharmaceutical, can I still get fired from my job? And then is there any legislation that they're going to fix the fact that, like, it's great that it's medically available, but I still can't use it?
So I would look to your actual jobs practices on hiring or firing with the cannabis to know about Epidiolex, which is the CBD med that she's talking about. However, and don't repeat that you got this from me, I've known a lot of people who've been on probation or in legal trouble who were using cannabis medically and wanted to continue while they needed to pass drug tests. And so they got prescriptions for Marinol, which is an FDA-approved Schedule 3 pure THC since 1986. And if you have a prescription for Marinol, you're allowed to have THC in your system when you take a drug test.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's the only thing they're testing for. So CBD, I don't think, is being tested for, but you need to check with your individual employer.
That is fascinating. We're talking with Angela Baca. She is an Oregon-based freelance journalist, author, editor, and political strategist. She has, over the last 10 years, been the editor of multiple publications, including Cannabis Now magazine, edited 8 cannabis books and nearly 1,000 professional articles on the topic. We'll be back with more of your calls for Angela. Boy, what a hot topic this has turned into right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with more of your calls for Angela right after this. Welcome back. David, watching us on Free Speech TV in Las Vegas, Nevada. David, you're on the air with Angela.
Hi. I was curious to know if I freeze in your pot, would that keep a THC high?
So I know some people who like to freeze their pot, and I think the THC is going to be high, but here's the thing you need to remember. When you freeze your pot, the trichomes, which is the part with all the medicine in it, become cold and brittle, and they fall off easy. So if you put a bag of weed in the freezer, you'll notice it's almost all kefir hash on the bottom if you move it when it takes out. So I would put hash in the freezer, maybe, but not the bud itself, unless you're trying to make hash.
I was just going to say, yeah. Isn't this a great way to separate out the...
It's a great way, actually. Some of the best cannabis is made fresh frozen, where they freeze it because the trichomes will just crack right off.
And
Trichome is the name of the gland that contains the cannabinoids that goes on the leaf.
Three parts, thus tri, or is it just
I don't know about why the name trichome, but if you were to look at a bud and you see all the sparkly stuff on the outside, those are the trichomes.
Ah, okay. George in Portland. Hey, George, you're on the air with Angela.
Hi there. Hi, Angela. Tom. Hey, I wonder if you could, Angela, address the misunderstandings about the damage from marijuana smoke and the safest way to smoke it. Also, what's the state of affairs in Oregon concerning vets with PSD? And I'll hang up and listen on the TV.
Thank you, George.
So, sorry, what was the first question? About smoking,
smoking, right? Yeah.
Okay, so with smoking, I can't really speak to if you have a lung condition particularly, but we do know that cannabis is way safer than smoking most anything. There was a government-funded research study, longitudinal over 20 years out of UCLA with Dr. Donald Tashkin, that showed people who were smoking marijuana actually had lower rates of lung cancer than people who were smoking nothing. So we don't really have any conclusive evidence that smoking's bad, although it can exacerbate some people's conditions. As far as vets and PTSD, I've known a lot of veterans who've actually moved here to Oregon because we have better care for our vets. However, the problem with vets and PTSD is going to be the same as it is everywhere else. The VA is not facilitating this. They're not helping you with it. The only way you're going to get cannabis to treat your PTSD is usually as a recreational user or if you can pay and find the money for a medical card.
Yeah, okay. Joan in Lodi, California. Joan, we have just a minute to the break. A quick one for Angela?
Yes, you mentioned Crohn's. Does she recommend something in particular, is it CBD oil or marijuana for treatment of anxiety, IBS, Crohn's?
Yeah, I do have Crohn's disease. I have a lot of people always asking me, what's the best strain for Crohn's disease? What's the thing I can do? Because everybody's always looking for a silver bullet. And I don't have a good answer for that question because what's worked for me is a multifaceted approach of managing my anxieties. Sometimes I use high CBD oil. That's a 1-to-1 THC CBD. Sometimes I smoke for nausea. Sometimes I take something different for insomnia. I treat the symptoms individually. If you do have anxiety, CBD is really helpful. And I do know there are studies in Israel sale right now where they're looking at very high amounts of CBD for Crohn's, but cannabis will not cure your Crohn's or your autoimmune disease. It'll treat it better than most pharmaceutical drugs. You have to look to other alternative therapies and do them in conjunction.
Yeah.
Diet.
We just have 20 seconds to the break, not enough time for a caller to call in. Could it be that the reason why people don't get lung cancer as frequently if they smoke pot is because it's an anti-inflammatory? And it's not the individual particles that are doing the damage to the lungs, it's the inflammatory response to them?
Maybe that and the fact that THC itself has anti-proliferative properties with cancer. So when THC comes in contact with a malignant cancer cell, it causes apoptosis or cell suicide. And so it literally shrinks tumors. And there are studies out of Madrid that the EU is funding that I was mentioning that will actually kind of speak to that more.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Amazing stuff. We'll be right back with more of your calls for Angela right after this. Welcome back. Angela Baca is with us answering your questions about all things pot. And let's see here, trying to prioritize how long people have been on hold here. Russ in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Russ, you're on the air with Angela.
Yeah, thank you very much for bringing this amazing young woman onto your air. My girlfriend suffers from insomnia and anxiety, and I suffer from osteoarthritis. So what do you have to say, Angela, about insomnia, anxiety, and osteoarthritis?
So with anxiety, I would start with higher CBD and then add in THC as you can control it. Insomnia, people tend to like purple strains or like the dark, musky indica strains. I personally like to take full extract cannabis oil, RSO, whatever we call it, and put it into a gelatin capsule. And when I put a little bit of that high THC RSO in a gelatin capsule and I have insomnia problems, I'll take it 2 hours before bed and sleep through the night. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, I've noticed that edibles work.
Oh, yeah.
They last all night, whereas just smoking it will get me to sleep, and then I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Part of that, too, is because when you digest THC, it converts in your liver to 11-hydroxy-THC, which is wildly more psychotropic, which is why you feel so high when you eat edibles, but it's also a lot more potent.
Well, that's interesting. The things we learn. Melinda in Kino Valley, Arizona. You're on the air with Angela Baca.
Hi. I have a question about quality. Here in Arizona, the growers are spraying their product. So the product that they sell in the dispensaries here is not pure. It's at least the leaf isn't. So my question is, if there are derivatives of pot in the ways that they do derive other oils or whatever, are they more pure? And is this a common practice in other states that they're spraying toxic chemicals in the growing arena?
So in legal states like Oregon, Washington, California, Colorado, and a lot of medical states, products have to be lab tested before they make it on the shelf, so they won't have that. I don't know about the specific regulations in Arizona right now, but this is part of the problem with how our marijuana's laws work. There's no good answer for me to you except that you should be illegally growing your own. And calling your legislators and requesting a full federal decriminalization and descheduling so that we have free markets that can cross straight lines and you can get better product.
Amen. Sean in Santa Rosa, California. You're on with Angela.
I think you wanted Sean?
Yeah, Sean, you're on the air.
Hey, I didn't hear you call my name. Hi, Tom. Hi, Angela. Thank you for this show. I consider myself kind of a rookie in this domain, and I started taking marijuana to help me sleep and kind of replace and subsidize a narcotic prescription. So I'm kind of like with you on that, Tom, and I like that dissociated feeling. It not goes away, but anyway, my question is, you know, edibles is very unpredictable for me. Sometimes it's like, wow, packs a wallop, and sometimes it's subtle. And then, so I started smoking more, and the smoking, yeah, a little concerned about it. I heard what you said to George about smoking, and that made me feel a little bit better about it. But I'm just wondering what the most predictable, consistent method of delivery might be.
We're back to volcanoes, right?
Cannabis, because it's a botanical plant and not a pharmaceutical drug that is standardized, it's going to be a little bit different based on the strain that you use. If you don't want to smoke, I would definitely use a Pax or a Volcano or another one of the good vaporizers. As far as edibles, the dosing thing is always the same. It's like putting salt on your food. You can always add more, but you can't take it off once it's there. So do a small amount and go from there. In legal states now, they're putting the recreational dose at 5 to 10 milligrams. I think 2.5 or 5 milligrams is the best for people to start with of THC if they are naive naive users, because then you'll kind of get an idea of the effects. But really, take the tiniest bite and wait 2 hours.
Yeah. Also, see, my experience has been that with edibles, that a lot of it has to do with whether my stomach is full or empty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So let's see. We just have 5640. We've got 1 minute. Ken in Ohio. Ken, you got the last question here for Angela. Quick one.
Thank you. I'm a barber, and I've had back trouble for 10 years. My question is, when I don't like to smoke because it makes me paranoid, but I get analgesic effects where I can actually work without taking pain medicine. And what is the difference between the CBD oil and THC?
There you go.
Thank you.
All right, and we've got 30 seconds, Ken.
The difference is the quantity of CBD and THC in each. Ohio's medical marijuana program is particularly messed up, and I know this because I did a long, intensive investigative journalism project on it last year. I would recommend to you, when you actually have access to product, to look for a one-to-one CBD to THC, because it seems to be really effective for pain, but it also helps kind of mitigate the effects of each that maybe you wouldn't want.
Great. Angela Baca, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
It's been great. And you can tweet Angela. Tell her thanks at Angela Baca, AngelaBacca. Angela Baca. Thanks so much for being with us. Jefferson Smith will be in for me tomorrow as I'm winging my way to L.A. for Bill Maher's show. And so I'll be back here on Monday. And Jefferson will do, I'm sure, a marvelous job tomorrow. But in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. We can't just sit around and go, oh, yeah, somebody else will take care of it. No, you have to get involved. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you. Well, I'll see you Monday. Jefferson will be here.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.